Bound. Welcome to the Book People. I'm your host, Aishwarya Zavalgekar, a writer, a book editor, podcast producer, and the head of originals at Bound. In this fascinating video podcast, I demystify the publishing and creative industries and uncover the biggest opportunities and challenges for writers in India today. So in part one, which is already out, we covered what exactly does copyright mean, what kind of rights do you have as a writer, and what kind of red flags should you be looking for in all of these contracts and agreements that you're signing with companies, with other creators for your work. So if you haven't seen that part yet, definitely check it out. In this part, which is part two of the conversation, I am talking to Sushrut about copyright and how it plays out in music, in video, in theater. We also talk about how laws need to adapt AI and what that is going to look like in the future. And I also have collected all of these questions from the Bound community about writing, about creation, about copyright that Sushrut answers, and we get right into the details of how copyright works practically. So let's dive in. In terms of copyright also, you know, because obviously with writer, when we're talking about films, we're talking about specifically the script. But if we look at purely the format, like video versus something in writing, you know, versus say a song, are there any changes in the copyright laws based on the format in which a final piece is? Because I know,
That's a great question. Because most of what we've said so far pertains to the written word, though it's very important to know that a musical work is also copyrighted. It is equally protected because it is a unique artistic work. Not only that, but the film that your script eventually becomes is copyrighted in and of itself. Yeah. Right? It is known, it's known quite archaically in the Copyright Act as a cinematograph film. So, So the cinematograph film has its own copyright. And once that comes into creation, once that comes into being, once that is published, as it were, your script becomes the underlying work of that. When a song is put out, the lyricist's work becomes the underlying work in the song. The composer of a song is also the underlying work in the eventual song, along with the writer.
Yeah, like the melody is a separate copyright, the lyrics are a separate, words are a separate copyright.
But then they all merge into the final work, which is why everything else is called underlying works.
Okay. Yeah, because I remember at some point during my undergrad reading basic media law. And I remember that even performances are copyrighted, right? Like if there's a theater performance that happens, there are these sort of some nuances of if a theater performance is recorded and then put on online, then that video is copyrighted.
Naturally.
And these kind of nuances as well.
It's a cinematograph film, right? It is moving pictures and audio, and it is an original artistic work. So it's a cinematograph film and it's protected.
Yeah. You're a lawyer. You work in, specifically in IP cases, you're working mostly with, you know, video, right? Like film, OTT. In order to be able to, say, argue these cases effectively, is it that you also need to have information about, you know, how the production works beyond the script, like details of how the production works or how the format works in order to be able to fight the cases? Or is it just sort of having an idea of the format is enough?
No. In fact, the beauty of litigation is that you have to be neck deep in whichever industry you're arguing in. Whichever industry your case relates to, you need to be neck deep in that. So I absolutely would. It's not an academic discipline. It's a very practical discipline. It's something that requires you to be aware of the industry practices. And the more knowledge you have of those, the better you can assist the court in understanding what actually has happened, what should have happened, things like that. So yeah, you can't be a hermit only studying academically.
Yeah, but even do you ever end up going on, say, sets, or like, you know, are you ever involved in the shoots, or you know, I mean, like quite physically, these processes that take place when a film is made.
No. I would never be on shoot. Mostly because.
Would you like to be on shoot?
I mean, I'd be curious. Sure, it'll be fun, but I doubt it'll really add anything to what I have to do. Most of my knowledge comes when people come to us. So we will have the producer coming to our office and he'll tell us, this is the thing, this is my director, this is what he did, this is why. They'll show me the documents. They'll prepare, you know, information that shows me what that is. Because, I mean, otherwise it becomes, frankly, just too time consuming. And the other problem is the physical problem, because, I mean, you also live in Mumbai, you know where our High Court is located, at the southernmost tip of the city.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
in Fort. Yeah. And where the film industry is, which is all the way in like Andheri and all.
Hmm.
So that's a trek that we don't usually make. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's fair. So, okay, what about you? Are you, you know, because it's the book people, so I have to talk about books. So, you know, do you read books? Are you a reader? What kind of books do you read?
Yeah, I'm an avid reader. I've been reading all my life. It's something that's given me tremendous joy. All my life, I don't think I could have got I don't think I would have passed my ICSE because of all that pressure. Without if I didn't have PG Woodhouse, I think I read like 40 PG Woodhouse novels in my 10th standard.
Very classics, yeah. Your tastes,
yeah. My grandfather, who's also a lawyer, and my father, who's not a lawyer, are both avid readers. So a lot of P.G. Woodhouse, Alistair MacLean, World War II novels, even older stuff like Robert Louis Stevenson, Kidnapped, things like Call of the Wild, Last of the Mohicans, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, all of Roald Dahl. And then after I grew up, things like Rushdie, Murakami, I read everything that he puts out. He's incredible. Who else? Let me look up on my bookshelf. Who else I have? R.K. Narayan, obviously.
Of course.
Mumbai Noir is a book I'm reading right now, which I'm absolutely enjoying. Then your... what else do I have? Jhumpa Lahiri, Joseph Heller, things like that.
Yeah. And do you read any Marathi books? Since Marathi, you talk about how we're born in Maharashtra.
Definitely. I can't read. So the problem is, I mean, it's entirely my fault. But after me, if I had to blame somebody, I would blame my school board, which only taught me years. So written Marathi is something that I never got into. We obviously speak it at home. But written Marathi is something I never got into. But every time I would be sick, as a kid, my mother would put in Pula Deshpande's tapes. And I'd be curled up in bed listening to that.
I was just going to ask you about Pula Deshpande, because, you know, obviously I am also not much of a Marathi reader or a speaker at this point, but that's just one of the classic names, you know, when you think of Marathi books, Pula Deshpande.
He's the greatest stand-up comic we've had, and one of that most people won't know.
Yeah. During university, I also had, in one of my literature courses, we had this exercise where we could take a short story in a non-English language, like whatever our mother tongue was or whatever. And we could translate it into English. And I had actually translated one of Pula Deshpande's short stories.
Achha.
It was very bad translation.
Was it funny
but
in the translation?
It was very difficult to translate the humor.
Exactly.
You know, and translate the nuances of the humor, because it was very Marathi humor.
Correct, correct.
How do you take that and put it in English and kind of...
No, it's very difficult. Have you seen this film that came out recently called Zombievilli?
No, there's a movie called Zombievilli, like Marathi movie.
It is too good. It's
like Dombivili, but zombies.
It's about zombies and Dombivili. And it's a brilliant satire, and it's a great movie. And I mean, I've showed it to all my non-Maharashtrian friends, and whatever, but they get maybe about 60% of the humor. It's a very funny movie.
Yeah.
But like with that typical that Marathi jokes, that is, I mean, like all regional languages, right? You need to speak it to understand it.
Zombievilli is such a good name. Like you did not have to explain it any further. I was like, yeah, zombie, Dombivilli makes sense. Oh, you're sold. I'm sold. I would watch that movie. What is the most common or what is the funniest misconception or, you know, story you've come across in terms of intellectual property where people think that, oh, this is something that I own IP for or that I own basically copyright for and I can fight for?
It's this only. The funniest thing is the people who come in with like a small germ of an idea saying, ye mera hai, and they want to stop everybody. And then
from creating that idea.
From creating that. And then we have to ask them, are bhai, these other 10 movies are being made in other countries. You please go stop them also.
Sometimes ideas are very unique, you know. I'm not saying that we should be able to copyright ideas, but I'll give you an example of this. I'm sure there are other books at this point. I have not looked it up. There might be. But you know, this book, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Night Time.
Yeah, great book.
Yeah, like that in itself, just the concept, right? Even before it was written, which is okay, here is this child, who clearly is on the spectrum.
Yeah,
and it's sort of that narrative of, you know, how people on the spectrum think and that child trying to solve this mystery of this dog, neighbor's dog who died. Like that in itself as a concept is so unique.
Correct. Now break that down, Ashwarya. Break that down. Is it unique to tell a story about an autistic child? Not really.
No.
Is it unique to tell a story about
an autistic a little child unique at this point.
To solve a mystery? Maybe it's a little unique, but it's not something we've never seen before, right? Like we've all read the girl with the dragon tattoo. How big a leap is it from there to think of a younger person doing a similar thing? Now, is it unique that a boy who's autistic investigating mysteries investigates a mystery of a neighborhood dead dog? Now it's getting pretty unique, right? So you see what's happening. The more
the layers
of it, the more unique elements that you can show are strung together in a very particular manner. Then that is what the court means when it says that we will protect the specific expression of an idea. So this is a very specific expression of the idea. And only that version of it will be protected. Not other versions.
Okay, like, so hypothetically, say I decide to write a book, which is an autistic child who is a boy, okay, who is again trying to solve the mystery of his neighbor's dog being dead, right? But the end of the mystery, the conclusion is different, which is what he ultimately sort of solves.
Yeah.
And it's set in Mumbai.
Yeah.
Is that a completely original thing that has no copyright infringement?
I mean, if you properly set it in Bombay and have unique characters in Bombay that feel authentic and real, then yeah, it's not a copyright infringement at all.
Right. Yeah, so the writing, obviously, the treatment of it, the writing, the details matter.
You watch Sarkar, right?
Yeah.
So is Sarkar the copyright infringement of Mario Puzo's Godfather? It's not,
yeah,
right?
I get your point. And it was very clearly giving an ode to it. So it was not trying to, in a way, hide the fact that it is inspired by, you know, because a lot of these...
Which is why it's an even better case. Which is why it's an even better example. You weren't even trying to hide it. You're talking about an example where a person attempts to hide it. I'm saying, look at a case where he hasn't tried to hide it. Even there, as a lay person, you will not think that it's copyright infringement. Right?
Right. Yeah, because a lot of these cases, right, where they will say, okay, inspired by this. And it's clearly like there are similar tropes, but it's clearly different enough for you to not think that this is like the difference between inspiration and plagiarism. Such a thin line to walk on.
This is a very thin line to walk on, which is why I tell all my writers, don't think you're going to be able to successfully walk on that line, you know, because obviously the defense will be that maybe it was inspired.
Yeah. What if someone has I want to write a book or a script about recent events that happened in India, right? How can people safeguard IP with that? Say if it is nonfiction, then it would come in this documentary, true crime sort of zone. And, you know, one is obviously safeguarding IP, but second is also just legally safeguarding themselves.
That's also a great question. Because here we have a variance between what the law is and what the practice is. So the law is that no person has a copyright on his own life. Your life is not a work of art. Your life is just your life. Right?
That's so sad.
So if you are a public figure and the things you have done are known to people, you cannot stop them from telling that story on the ground that it is your story and you have copyrighted it. You can't do it.
Right.
So, which is why you had in 1 year in Bollywood, 3 movies on Bhagat Singh.
Mm-hmm.
In 1 year, we saw 3 movies, 3 different people playing Bhagat Singh. Not one of those producers could accuse the other of plagiarism because it was a real figure. The yeah. descendants of Bhagat Singh couldn't stop any of it saying, "Arey, ye hamara copyright hai, aap kaise bata rahe?" Because the man is a public figure, he's a national hero, his life is well documented. We all know what he did. And his story belongs to the public, to all of us. It's part of public discourse. It is what is known as being in the public domain.
Hmm. What about recent examples? For example, you know, the movie No One Killed Jessica, which was, you know, based on a very like recent thing, especially with true crime, you know, a lot of these true crime, whether it's movies, podcasts, books kind of coming up, that question comes again and again, right? Or there was the whole Jolly Joseph case, which was turned into a podcast, you know, a true crime podcast. So these very similar things, say something that happened 5 years ago, which today I decide to write a book on, or, you know, I decide to make a film out of. What are the rights there? Because one is obviously the person, say it's a murder case, right? So one is obviously the accused who is alive. But then it also involves other family members or say other people involved who are alive, who will get affected.
Correct.
You know,
this is exactly where your difference between the law and the practice comes in. Because even though the law tells you that these people don't have copyright in their lives, practically speaking, they can still file a defamation case against you.
Right.
That is something we saw with the Phoolan Devi documentary. That is something we saw very recently in Delhi with this new movie called Faraz, with the Hansal Mehta film with Zayan Kapoor, which was based on a terrorist attack in Dhaka, where one Indian girl died. And the Indian girl's family moved the Delhi High Court, trying to stop the movie from being released. Now, obviously, she couldn't stop it on the ground that I have copyright in my daughter's life. But the attempt was... Because that's not an argument that's going to fly. But the argument that was made is that you are, in that sense, imagining and fictionalizing what would have happened in that cafe and casting my daughter as one of the characters there, because we all know that it was my daughter in there. You are defaming her after her death. You are violating her right to privacy.
Mm.
And therefore, you must be stopped. And therefore, this movie cannot be released. Now, practically, what would happen is filmmakers like this would take NOCs from all people involved. But this may be one family that perhaps didn't want to give the NOC. And perhaps, I mean, I don't know any of this. I'm just...
Hypothetical.
Hypothetically, I'm just using this Faraz incident as a sort of jumping off point for a similar such situation. Hmm. Where they said that you're defaming me. You are... You're defaming my daughter. You are... sort of tarnishing her memory, and you're violating her right to privacy. And the court, after initially giving an injunction at the ad interim stage, finally, when it heard the application, it said that no, you don't have this right to privacy, unfortunately, once your story becomes public. And that story
is
then...
How important is news in this sense? You know, because is it that the story is public because there was so much news coverage about it? Say it was an incident that did not have news coverage and so was not publicly known. Would that affect?
It depends what your sources are. If your sources are public domain, then it's fine. But what I mean by that is, if your source is a trial that happened in an open court where anybody was allowed to come, but practically only you showed up and you took notes, that's fine. You can tell that story. Nobody can stop you. But I would still advise you, and this is a practice that is followed in India, to sign something known as a life rights agreement. I would still advise such a person that please sign it for whatever it is worth, because at the bad end, it will prevent you from being sued for defamation. And at the good end, you might get some stories that you would not otherwise have got without sitting down with this person and merely sitting in court and taking notes or reading newspaper articles.
Yeah. Okay. And this is true for both fiction and nonfiction. Like whether as a creator you want to make a fictionalized version or whether you want to make a nonfiction.
Obviously, in nonfiction, you really must do it in a documentary because you're literally going to be possibly showing their face, taking their real name. In fiction, there is a little more wiggle room if you change their name, change the character's name. But as we saw in the case of this film Faraz, even though the name Faraz was real, the other names were fictionalized and that didn't stop a case from being filed.
Right.
And that didn't stop an injunction from being granted for several months.
Yeah. Okay. What about AI? You know, there's all this conversation now happening about AI and the ethics of AI and how it's going to take over, you know, for all the creators and everyone will be left sort of jobless. So, you know, when I was reading up on copyright, I saw this thing about how in 2021, there was a painting called Suryast, for which an AI called Raghav was recognized as a co-author. Because there was someone, you know, using the AI, but they decided to sort of put the, say, I am using an AI to write, I don't know, a book.
Correct.
And then the book is sort of copyrighted as co-authored by me and this AI.
Right.
So, and that was something that was, you know, granted.
Right.
So what does that mean for copyright law, for creators who want to, whether it's writers or whether, you know, it's sort of digital creators, musicians, what does this mean for the future of?
So firstly, Ashwarya, we are at a very, very, very nascent stage in this. And the way this law, the way any law in a sort of frontier territory like this works is we make mistakes. We will, because everybody, including the judges, the lawyers, the industry, everybody's trying to find what is the fair ground. Now this example that you gave where the AI is credited as the co-author, it's interesting. We should see where this takes us. Though something that I would say immediately on hearing that is that the AI itself is a program, right? The AI is a piece of software. And under existing copyright law, a software is copyrightable and has an owner. It has an author.
Right.
So when you say the AI is the author, are you saying that the author of the AI is the author?
Right. So then if I author an AI, then any piece of work that gets created using that AI, does that mean that I am an author of all, like I'm a co-author in a way, in all the creation of all of those pieces, right?
It would be very dangerous if that was so. Because see, on the positive side is this Suryasta painting made with an AI and usko naam mil gaya and wow, my co-painter is an AI.
Yeah.
But think of the flip side of it. If this creator of the AI wants to say that, oh, don't put that AI's name, put my name because I'm the author of that program that did this, then he's also going to be liable for all the for all the infringement. And this is something that we are seeing a lot with things like DALL-E and a lot of these image generation AI programs, Midjourney, things like that, where I can literally put in, make me something in the style of, say, Rohan Joglekar. Now, Rohan Joglekar is a very prominent up-and-coming Indian artist. And if I say, make me a painting of this thing in the style of Rohan Joglekar, they will do it. The AI will do it. But the way the AI will do it is it will find Rohan Joglekar's paintings, scrub off whatever are the similarities, and just rearrange some of those elements and put them into my work. And rightly, Rohan would be absolutely justified in being furious that his work is being used to create new works without any attribution to him, without any royalties being paid to him. And then who's responsible for that? That is also the author of that AI program.
Yeah.
And that, why did you create an AI that steals art? Right? Firstly, there is no law written. Right? There is no... Currently, the copyright law says that a human being only can create art. Now, some of that was came to challenge with the monkey selfie. I don't know if you know about this. There was a monkey in a forest who took a selfie with a camera that a photographer had left. And that photo was published by a magazine without paying the guy who owned the camera, the photographer.
The photographer.
Saying that this is not your photo. This photo was taken by a monkey. So you don't have copyright on it. So what's happening is that, like, these edge cases are just that. They're edge cases. You can't set ground rules on the basis of edge cases. But at some point in time, with this profusion in AI art, with the blurring of the lines, especially in digital art, between what is a tool and what is AI, that's going to be blurred. If I'm making something on an iPad with a pen, and I use that software that can mimic a brush or a sketch pen or a pencil or whatever, is it that much of a leap from there to have the help of an AI saying, "Achha, just do a little bit shading here, just do a little bit of clouds there"? So, is it a question, or is it a difference in degrees, or is it a difference in category? These are the kind of questions that are going to have to be answered. And there's going to have to be legislation, and that's not going to be the end of it. We have what we sometimes flippantly call the third house of parliament, which is the courts. So the Indian courts will have to weigh in on that. And only then, possibly years later, can we have an authoritative answer to this question.
Yeah, for sure. There'll be years of back and forth and, you know, changes based on also new things that will keep coming up, right?
Because
even AI now, people are kind of starting to realize and use it. So even I think that will keep evolving. In terms of whether, agree with you, that question of, you know, whether it's a tool, whether it's a creator in itself.
Yeah.
And then how do we create it?
All open questions right now.
Yeah, comes important. Okay, I have a few crowdsourced community questions. These were all of mine. The first one is, you know, in terms of, because we discussed, for example, the idea of public domain, right? Once something is created, obviously for around 60 years, I think, depends medium.
60 years after the death of the creator.
Yeah. In India, it's 60 years after the death of the creator, right? Which is the same as UK.
Yeah.
But not US.
Yeah. US is extending it to protect Mickey Mouse, but that's also run out now.
Yeah. Is that why they were extending it? It was purely for Mickey Mouse.
Yeah, purely for Mickey Mouse. And now Disney has finally changed its mascot. It's no longer going to be Mickey Mouse. So finally, they're allowing copyright to lapse and allowing Mickey Mouse to enter the public domain. Yeah, that's pretty much the only reason why America's different. Because Disney is that powerful.
That's really cool. Once something gets in, you know, is a part of the public domain, what rights does the work still have? Like, one is obviously I can reproduce it as is and call it what it originally is, right? Say if it is Premchand ki kahaniya, or, you know, recently I was looking up like Agatha Christie novels and how some of them are slowly starting to come into the public domain.
Yeah.
Right. So say if I do a print run of one of the novels that is in the public domain, but I call it the same title and I put Agatha Christie. Is fine and I can make money off of that.
Yes.
What if I take two chapters from that novel and I put it in my novel and I put a book out? Is there still copyright infringement?
The only right that somebody like Agatha Christie or whoever would have after their death, if their works are published, is the right of attribution, which means tell people that I was the one who wrote it. That's it. Print it. That's how Sherlock Holmes is published all over. Like every Indian publisher has some version of Sherlock Holmes. Some version means some publication of Sherlock Holmes. And all of it is legal because you're saying that Sir Arthur Conan Doyle wrote it, and then it's fine.
Yeah. Cool. We also discussed NDAs before, and you know, you also mentioned some red flags for writers to look at in contracts. Within NDAs itself, are there any red flags or any verbiage that people should look out for? Like, can NDAs also be exploitative?
So I know this is something that there is a bit of a panic around in the industry, and it's because of this reverse NDA I was telling you about, where the producers will hand you a two-pager to sign. My personal view is that it's okay. I know a lot of that language seems like it's quite harsh and attacking you, because it says things like, oh, we do lots of projects. We have lots of projects in development. Maybe one project that we have in development is like your project. So then, you know, you never know. And then the writer gets scared that, oh, what are you saying? Are you going to use it against me? My view of the matter is it's actually a very good thing if it says that, because then when I go to court, I will say that, see, you made me sign this document that said that you may have these other projects. Now that we are seeing this alleged plagiarism happen, this surely must have been one of those other projects that were in development from before. So just show the court that it was in development before. And that's the end of the matter. I'll lose the case. I'll go out.
Right. It puts that onus on the producer, right, saying, okay, right, oh, if you are saying that this was something that you were working on already, prove it.
Show it. Yeah. Show it to the court.
Yeah. Okay. Makes sense.
So I don't get scared of those NDAs personally. Though I know writers really like shirk from them. They're like, because I think they get insulted by the language more than anything else.
So. I think all contracts, you know, whether it's publishing contracts, I have noticed with writers, as far as I have worked with them, like any kind of contract, just contracts are scary.
Yeah.
Because of the language, you know, and so much of it is, it just seems like normal words, but they mean something else legally than they do when sort of you and I are just having a conversation.
Correct.
And that fear of, you know, even if I'm reading it, I'm not able to actually interpret, or I'm reading it a certain way, but someone else can just come and say, oh, but that's not what it meant here. I'm interpreting it differently.
I know.
I think very scary.
I fully sympathize, because it is very opaque. It is written in roundabout language, especially with some of the bigger contracts that come from the bigger producers. It is deliberate that it is written in a roundabout manner. It is intended to confuse you, yeah, and it is intended to intimidate you. That is the point of it. So, yeah, I fully sympathize with it.
What can writers do about it?
I think definitely have your contracts read by a professional. It's accessible now. It's not so expensive. And especially if you think that what you're working on is something that's very valuable to you, very close to you, something that you want to protect, then put in that investment. If you think of yourself as a businessman and not an artist, then you wouldn't mind investing a little bit of money in yourself, you know? Especially because it can really protect you in the long run. And then once you do it a few times, once you get professional advice a few times, I guarantee you it's not complicated. Third time around, you'll know it.
Yeah, it's also a learning curve. It's not that every time you will need the same amount of professional advice. It's like once, maybe if you know, then the next time you also know that there are these words that you need to look out for, or you kind of learn from that.
You know, all the professional screenwriters who I know, who are like 15, 20 years plus in the industry, they are as good lawyers as I am. They'll send me a contract marked up saying, oh, this, I don't like it. So, what do you think? Problem hai? I said, let's say, ah, sir, barabar hai, problem hai isme. They already know it.
Yeah. It's another skill set, right? It's like the way you're learning as a writer to kind of, I wouldn't say write better, but you're learning new techniques, you're learning new tropes, yeah, you're kind of growing in terms of skills as a creator, as a writer. This is just one of the skill sets that you need to also grow in almost simultaneously. That's it's right. Like if you're creating, then also brush up on your legal.
Correct.
Abilities.
Producers do it, right? Why not you?
Yeah, that's true. I think producers just seem like this like big bad, even if they're small companies or independent producers. I think it's just that perception of, oh, me, this individual, like David and Goliath.
They like to give that impression. It's not true. It's all an illusion. They like to give that impression. On the door of SWA, no, Ashwarya, there used to be this line. It was literally painted out on a foolscap sheet. It said, without the writer, all you have in a film is a blank piece of paper.
Mm.
So, I think it's high time that writers also start realizing their own power, their own influence. They have in the West, and now we are starting to realize it here also.
Yeah. That's a good one. I like. Okay, I have one question, last question, that was crowdsourced. I find this question very interesting. So, you know how we like spoke a little bit about music as well. So, someone has asked, what are the laws around using music or, you know, lyrics of a song in a book? So, say in a book, they want to mention the lyrics of a song and sort of put them down, or say, that's oh, fine. This character was listening to this song.
That's
how
fine.
Much of the music can they put it? How much
if you're quoting lyrics, you know, in a book, that's absolutely fine. It's lyric. I mean, these are all pieces of pop culture. There's no reason why they can't be referenced. These are all things in the public domain. What you can't do, for anybody who has this doubt in their head, what can I do, can't I do on this axis? Broadly, you can't make money off of that. So you can't print their lyrics in a book of 50 greatest lyrics and sell it. Right?
Okay.
But if you have a character who says, Aati kya khandala, for example, to another character in a book, there's no way that anyone's going to catch your neck and say, oh, that line was my song and all that. Doesn't it? That would fail.
Yeah. What if a character is actually listening to music? It's like, oh, they're listening to music, or they're singing the lyrics, you know? Like, oh, it's like, oh, this character went on stage and they're singing a song, and then it's the full entire lyrics of that song just printed verbatim on the page. Is that a problem?
Firstly, I'd like to see the editor who agrees to publish something like that. It would be extremely boring to have the entire lyrics of a song put out there. So practically, I don't know if that's ever going to happen. But yeah, I mean, you shouldn't be reproducing wholesale. And I don't think that any occasion would arise to reproduce something like that wholesale. And it would be judged in the context of what the work is. If the work stands on its own footing, if the work is an original literary work, then merely because it quotes some other works, it's not going to be considered an infringement. But the situation is very different in a film. In a film, if you have a character listening to a song, he can't listen to a song unless you have the license to play it.
Yeah.
So we are talking about books here. In a film.
Yeah.
Like
even in podcasts, right? You need to license any music that is being played, even if it is a snippet or, you know, a part of it. It needs to be licensed to
have
those, you know, like to be able to play that music, and it needs to be credited.
Yep.
All of those things. So music licensing has become its own thing, especially now. I mean, it always was, but as audio storytelling is growing, podcasts are, you know, more and more people are creating podcasts. I think that is something that people actually don't realize, where, you know, they'll use music, or now there are a lot of these royalty-free sites.
Yeah.
Right, online, where you just get royalty-free music, but a lot of time it's not right. Royalty-free.
Not royalty-free. So yeah.
So I know, like, a lot of podcasters end up using it, or I think it's happening now even in advertisements, where a couple of times advertisers have used some music, which then later it's identify that it's an original track by a musician and creates these issues.
Right. Yeah, you can't do that.
So I have a very short, very quick rapid fire round.
Okay.
I'll just be asking you questions. If you can answer as soon as possible, quickly.
Sure.
Yeah. The first one is very easy. So books or movies?
Books.
Okay. This was the easiest one. I think this might not be a rapid fire, but let's try it out. One thing all writers should do to safeguard their work.
Do everything in writing. Make sure everything is in writing. Make sure there's a paper.
Have a paper trail.
Yep.
Yeah, love that word, that term.
Yeah.
Okay. If you weren't a lawyer, what career would you want to pursue? What would you be?
I wanted to be a marine biologist for the longest time because I love being in the water. Really? I love scuba diving. So if I didn't have to live in the city and earn a living, I'd probably be researching whales in Tonga or something like that.
That's really cool. I'm sure. I mean, I know people who make a living doing that, just not that good at
living. Also, you should connect later to see if I can go and dive with them.
Yeah, for sure. One book that you think everyone should read?
If you're an Indian, without a doubt, Midnight's Children.
Hmm.
It's one of the greatest stories of our founding, and a lot of people get scared of Salman Rushdie. I don't know why. Just get into it. Give it 50 pages. You'll understand how he talks, how his voice, and then it's a breeze. And don't look back. Or also the Ibis trilogy by Amitav Ghosh, which is also one of the greatest Indian stories, in my opinion, ever told. I don't know why it's not a series yet. It would be the greatest series.
Maybe they're working something out. Let's see.
Yeah.
Okay. My last question is, any sort of, what is one thing that you want to say to writers or creators in India today?
don't have an inferiority complex. Certainly not with producers.
That's a good one. I think that's something every writer needs to hear. Any creator today else, don't have an inferiority complex.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Sushrut, for coming here. I hope you had fun talking about.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun. It was great. It was a lot of fun.
Okay. Thank you so much for being a part of this and for being a part of the book people. And I'm sure that writers will get a lot of, you know, they're just going to be making notes with all the points that you've made about how they can.
Always help writers.
That marks the end of another episode of The Book People. Tune in every Thursday for some breakdowns, some truth bombs, and some insightful and real conversations with industry experts about all things books. This podcast is created by Bound. We work with writers and brands to create content across formats, whether it's books, podcasts, newsletters, or screenplays. So get in touch to see how we can help you grow through stories and follow us at Bound India on all social media platforms. I'm your host, Aishwarya Zawargekar. You can follow me on LinkedIn where I share many, many more insights about books and content. Or you can get in touch with me at aishwarya@boundindia.com if you have any suggestions on topics I should cover or if you want to book any of my services or consultation calls. Until then, keep writing.